Session number 10880.
Mr. Puril 5.
And we took the suspects back to A Company headquarters. And from there, I understand they were returned to Brigade headquarters, where they were questioned and found not to be Dutch, but to have Dutch relatives in Eindhoven.
So what happened to them, did you hear?
No, nothing. Nothing at all further.
Any other memories from keeping that watch on the Maas?
Yes. We were in one position or one place where during the day we could make use of these farm buildings, and in the evenings with manned slit trenches dug just outside the farm buildings. But part of the track back to the company headquarters, which we were screening, was under observation and could come under fire if there was movement seen. And we're supposed to go to this centre, the company headquarters, to obtain our meals, which meant coming under fire. And we found on this farm some goats and tethered them. I've got pictures of them somewhere. And tethered them to a cart and sent them off up the track, and they were stopped at the top by the company headquarters there, and our food put in hot containers, put on the truck, turned around and sent back to us, and the goats pulled them backwards and forwards. I think we were able to get them to do it because they were given a treat of carrots or something at each end and had got used to it. And then it was after that, except for the New Year's Day German air offensive against the Eindhoven aerodromes and cannon shelling on the way back, it was fairly quiet.
Did you see anything of that Luftwaffe attack?
Oh, the aircraft swept over us. Mm.
Strafing?
On the way back home. Yes, they did. They'd done a bit of strafing. Mm. They swept straight over, not only our brigade area, because we're more or less in front of Eindhoven, a few miles. So by the time they'd been down Eindhoven and the air bases back there, they were fairly low. I bet there must have only been, 100 foot, if that, the bombing. And they were heading back, streaking back for home, across the Maas and the Rhine, you see. But it was quiet then until, I think it was in February, when the offensive opened up again and we made our push into Germany.
This wasn't the Reichswald battle?
No, that came before that. That was the start of it, really.
What was your personal involvement?
None in the Reichswald. Our regiment was involved in it, and indeed, one of the corporals in our platoon, he went off on with another person, just two of them, and penetrated behind the German lines in a Reichswald to observe. And I think he stopped there 2 or 3 days and came back to make his report then and was awarded a military medal for him. He'd got a military medal, that's right, he was awarded a bar to him. can't think of his name. He was a Geordie, and originally he'd come from, I think, Tyne and TT division.
What did you personally do in February?
Not a lot. I can't remember doing anything out of the ordinary of just being in defensive positions. And then we moved forward. But, of course, it was raining and muddy. Now, where did we go? We went up through Wallen, that's right. After crossing the Mars, we headed for Apeldoorn, I think. And crossed the German border near Apeldoorn. And I remember going, the first place we got to in Germany was a farm. Quite a big one. And there wasn't a soul about. No one was about. For about half an hour, then all of a sudden, two girls came into a barn, and they were Russian, being sent from Russia to work on the farm. Somehow or other, we asked them where the people was, and they said down, so they were in the cellar, all the family. So I went down into the cellar, and everybody was absolutely petrified with fright. The little children were sort of screaming. Anyway, we gave them some chocolate and told the family they could come up. And when they came up, the old man asked us if we could send a letter to his daughter, who was in England. And I said, well, if you write it, we can ask for it to be sent through the Red Cross. And he produced a photo of a sergeant's mess photograph of the King's Shropshire Light Infantry Regiment, of the sergeant's mess when they were occupation of the Rhine in the 1920s. And his daughter had married one of the sergeants. So he was quite kindly disposed to us, though we treated them all with suspicion. And once they knew that we wasn't going to sort of slaughter them all or burn the barn down or anything, they did give us some butter and milk. And then after that, we moved on and left them to it.
So you were just moving through without opposition?
We didn't really get any more opposition till we got to the Dortmund Ems Canal. I think it was Dortmund Ems, by Solingen somewhere.
What happened there?
Well, there was a battle to cross the canal itself. And I think this was the one where one of the King's Shropshire Light Infantry young soldiers got a VC there on the Dortmund Ems, or approaching it, or. But really, because it had been. So the rifle companies were advancing on tanks and stuff. And it became a matter of routine movement as far as we were concerned. Because they cleared any opposition, and by this time, opposition was collapsing. And the next time we met up with any was in the battle for Bremen.
What happened there?
Well, there was plenty of shelling going on from our side to start, and air attacks. And we started, we advanced from, I think it was Asten, or Aston, towards Bremen. Now, one or two of the other units I know later met up with some resistance because there was some SS around in Bremen. And then we got allocated the task of going reconnaissance down into Bremen, did our carrier section. And we went down, as I can always recall it because I looked up and saw it, down a place called Corn Street, Kornstrasse. And there was no trouble. It was a hell of a mess. And the amazing thing was that there were groups of Germans collecting water from standpipes because the whole system had broken down. And as we went by in our armoured vehicles, we just sort of say, "Morgan, Morgan," as though it was an everyday occurrence to have foreign troops occupy a city. And we did occupy Bremen until, must have been about 4 or 5 days, I think, that we were in Bremen itself. And it was pretty disorderly at the time because there were a lot of Russians about who had been released from prison camp or forced labour, or what claimed to be forced labour, and they were drunk. They'd broke into the brewery and were swigging pure alcohol and was rushing about shooting up houses and raping women and all sorts. So we had turned out to do patrols to keep the place quiet, if you know what I mean. You know, not looking for anybody, but making sure that some sort of law and order did exist while the German police could get reorganised, because Bremen was in a terrible state from bombing and shelling and everything. They'd had about 50 major air raids. See?
Did you apprehend or shoot any of the Russians?
I didn't apprehend any. And after 3 or 4 days, we then moved on out of Bremen, heading in the general direction of Hamburg. We're on our way through Delmenhorst, and then we got word through that the war had ceased.
Whilst you were passing through Germany, did you come across any of the concentration camps?
No. We didn't go along that route. So the Belsen was on halfway between Salto and Hamburg, and we hadn't got as far up as Salto, because Belsen is Bergen-Belsen. I've been there, I've been to see it since the war finished. And, of course, as usual, all the Germans living around there deny any knowledge of it. but it's, as soon as they said the war finished, the very next day, we moved to our allocated zone of occupation.
Where was that?
Which was a Petershagen on the Weser, by about 4 or 5 miles from Minden.
How did the occupation troops behave towards the Germans?
Exemplary. I think they had had enough of war, everybody had, and thought it was time to get down to living a more civilised life. But there again, there was no trouble from the Germans. They said all they wanted, it was an agricultural area, and all they wanted to do was get on with their own life, because they'd had no troops around there. and were more worried about getting the harvest in than bothering troops. And indeed, were more worried about gathering the harvest in because of the forthcoming winter and knowing it would be a bad winter and that there'd be an intense food shortage.
I know there was a non-fraternisation order issued. Did the troops obey that?
More or less. They didn't when they could get away with it.
Did you obey it?
Not always, no. No. I associated and mixed with the Germans and spoke to them.
Did you like them?
Some I did and some I didn't.
What was the problem with the ones that you didn't like?
Well, they had this underlying surly resentment that they had lost the war or against the British. Or quite often they said to us, if we'd have had Churchill as a leader, we would have won. I don't know where the sense of that came in, but that's what they used to say. The children we found were very honest and were very helpful.
Did you come into contact with the Russian army?
Only once, when they were invited over to the battalion, really as a social reception.
What impression did they make on you?
Not a lot.
Why not?
Pleasant, but very wary and were distrustful.
What was the attitude of the German population towards the Russian army?
Frightened of them.
Do you think they had...
Petrified of them, in fact.
Do you think they had cause to be?
Oh, yes.
Why do you think that?
Well, after I left the Warwicks, I went to the Royal Leicesters in August of 45. And they were at a small place called Hemer, H-E-M-E-R, by Iserlohn. And there was a large barracks there, which were full of Russian former prisoners and forced labour. And they used to go out from the barracks, although they wasn't supposed to do so, at night, raiding German farms and homesteads. And when they raided these places, the usual thing, as well as stealing cattle, which they killed, or pigs and stuff to bring back, was to rape any women that were on the property. And if any men tried to interfere, they would shoot them, kill them off, and then proceed to wreck the place, just wanton damage, like ripping all the lights out of the ceiling and kicking the windows in and smashing the furniture and stealing anything they could lay their hands on. And I know the patrols was organised within the areas to stop this. And eventually it was overcome by linking up outlying farms and districts by field telephones so that they could warn each other, which in turn phone into the nearest military who would send patrol out.
Was the sympathy of the British soldiers with the German civilians or with the Russian displaced persons?
I think the thing was that we realised that the Russians had got a lot to be resentful about, and understood their feelings. But at the same time, we hadn't grown up in a situation or a culture, shall we say, whereby that sort of thing was tolerated or accepted as the norm. So we resented them doing it. And to go around raping young girls and the mothers and things and wrecking property just for the sake of wrecking it wasn't, you know, within our thoughts. We didn't think much of that at all. Though we agreed that they'd had enough provocation to make them do anything like that.
So the British soldiers did their best to stop it, did they?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, we sort of acted as policemen trying to stop it without it, any bloodshed or anything on the other side. There was one occasion, that was when we was at Petershagen.
And if it hadn't been so serious, it would have been funny.
See, when the Germans were retreating through Germany, they strapped aircraft bombs, 250 or 500 kilogram aircraft bombs, under bridges to demolish the bridges to delay us. Well, by this time, the generals, etc., must have realised that the war was lost and that the bridges would be needed, so they were never blown. And we employed former German army, or were still were prisoners, engineers, to dismantle them. And they were bringing them back to a place just outside Petershagen and stacking them in a field on wooden pieces of wood beaming and then stacking them pyramid fashion. Quite a number of them, I mean a lot of them. And near, on the other side of the river from us, in a there was a village that had been completely given over to Polish displaced persons who were waiting repatriation. Now these acted in a more civilised manner than the Russians, but they still went round seeing what they could scavenge or spin. And they came across these bombs, all stacked up, and they lit a fire under them and stood back to see what happened. And of course it happened, they went off. And I think there was about a couple of hundred either killed and injured altogether.
Amongst the Poles?
Yeah. And they just left this huge crater. And we heard and felt the shock, heard the bang and felt the reverberations in Petershagen.
Jumping ahead again, when you were with the Royal Leicesters in Hong Kong in 1949, this was the time of the fall of China to the communists.
Yes, the communists were then overrunning China, and when they got to Shanghai, the government decided to reinforce the colony in case the communists, on reaching the borders, decided to overrun the Kowloon Peninsula and attempt to capture Hong Kong. And we were posted on the, at the time the nationalists were still there, Chiang Kai-shek, and we were posted on the border near Lo Wu. And there we dug a defence line across the hills, and practice various exercises designed to meet any threat from the communists. And at the same time developed the territory. When we first went into the new territories, the only thing there was a certain amount of electricity and a road that ran round the along the perimeter border and down into Kowloon. And camps had to be built up there, so electric was laid on, water was laid on, and at Sekong, there was a complete new, more or less, military township constructed. That's where they have got the Vietnamese refugees now. But when we first went there, there was nothing at all. And then he developed, and we sat there on the border, and then when the communists did eventually get to the border, they acknowledged the border and didn't come over. But millions of refugees did. And they were sleeping in the streets in Kowloon and Hong Kong and anywhere else that they could stay.
You were just letting them come across freely, weren't
you? Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Apparently the Chinese in Hong Kong, that sorted the Chinese, the police, Hong Kong police, that sorted any known communists out from the refugees. And of course, once the communists got down there, the border was closed in its entirety. The communists wouldn't allow any trains to go through from Kowloon through Lowu up to Canton and things like that. That was just finished.
Did you see the arrival of the communist troops?
Yes, it was on a Saturday, not early hours of Sunday morning, that they did get to the border. Saturday evening, Sunday morning. But nothing out of the normal happened, really. Just the troops just manned. We just manned the border. But nothing else. I mean, within a couple of hours, everything was back down, stand down and carry on normal.
Did you really think that they'd cross the border?
I didn't, no, and a lot of others didn't. Because there was a lot of stuff there, you see. I think there's about 22,000 British troops in Hong Kong, all told. And then you got the fleet, the Far East Fleet and stuff, as well as the Air Force. They got, at that time, they got the Spitfire, the Typhoons, and they just started to get delivery of the Phantoms, the jets. So it's quite a powerful force, and I think that they must have realised, the communists, that they were going to put the head in the lion's mouth if they'd have tried it.
Now, can you tell me about your involvement with the Malayan emergency, with the Malayan scouts, please?
Yes, while we were in Hong Kong, a notice came round asking for people who would be interested in forming Malayan scouts to help to combat the emergency, which was then appeared to be leaning in favour of the communists. This was, I think it was July 1950. And Mike Calvert, Colonel Mike Calvert, who I'd heard